Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Don't miss the Crypt Rick and Jonathan Show every Saturday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Studio B, right here at Revolution Radio.
The journey begins to fun, health, and freedom.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so obvious, makes you so sick at heart. You can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it. That unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you got it.
Right, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me,
give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the deep state criminal power structure that has ruled over our planet for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given rights, and we shall not yield that right to any power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at, and I am your host on The Tipping Point. On Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in this ensuing takedown of this global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw, hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
All right. Good morning. Good afternoon. Good evening. Wherever you are in the world, I've turned into Del Bigtree. I've no intention of ever turning into Del Bigtree. Welcome to Free Association. It's 4 p.m. in the UK, which makes it 11 a.m. on the East Coast in the US. I'm here pretty much every Saturday between now and Christmas at least. I've got no plans to take any time off until the next Mercury retrograde, which will be 3 weeks in a row when it happens. And I shall just continue on. That's all you can do in the face of political intrigue and political chaos and financial chaos and wars, endless wars, rumors of wars, you name it, there's a war involved in it somewhere at the moment. So we're kind of repeating the 1930s somewhere down the line, repeating the 1970s, repeating the 1930s. And with my astrological head on, I would say there was something involving a Chiron return, but I don't always have my astrological head on. And the 1920s is the Uranus cycle. It's an 84-year cycle. So that takes us back to, what, I'm not even going to work it out, but it's somewhere around about the late 20s, early 30s, so we're probably about to hit a repeat or a slight variation of the Great Depression, and then followed by a world war in about 10 years' time. That's something to look forward to. I'm in a strange mood today, it has to be said. I'm in a very, very strange mood today. But I'll just talk and see what happens. I really, I don't know. I'm watching British politics, and every time I look at it, it's changed. Every time I look at it, it's changed. It's ridiculous, man. Totally ridiculous. So there was this Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday afternoon, and it was Liz Truss's second Prime Minister's questions as Prime Minister, and she didn't do a great job. She didn't do a bad job. She was kind of middling. Not very inspiring, though. Keir Starmer did a good job of making his point. Liz Truss was spouting slogans, as she always does, with what looks like just robotic lack of conviction. She's kind of... I don't know who she is. She's certainly not Margaret Thatcher, though. I know she's trying to emulate Margaret Thatcher, but she's definitely not Margaret Thatcher. She's not even Theresa May, really. There's some issues with Liz Truss. She won't be there by Christmas. I guarantee she won't be there by Christmas. If she's still there at Christmas, then everybody around her would have changed, and she'll be on gardening leave, effectively. Gardening leave is what happens to the police or the civil service when they do something that they're not supposed to do, and the police don't want it to be public. They'll put you on gardening leave. Civil service do the same thing. So it's a way of keeping you on the books, keeping you on the payroll, but you don't get access to any information. You don't get to influence any decisions. You don't get to do anything. But you will get paid. So that's effectively the way that Liz Truss is going to end up. She's going to be on gardening leave. If she's still got the title of Prime Minister at the end of this month, where are we now? We're middle of October. By the end of this month, she'll be on gardening leave. I pretty much guarantee it. There's I saw a headline that says the vultures are circling this morning when I went shopping. So yeah, the vultures are circling. She's wounded. She's bleeding. If we're going to use this analogy, she's in the process of dying. She's walking through the desert. It's hot. She doesn't have any water. She doesn't have any food. She can see a mirage of an oasis ahead of her. So she's cracking on. She thinks she'll get to the oasis and she'll be fine. Meanwhile, the vultures are circling above. And they can smell blood, and she won't last till the end of the month. If she's still Prime Minister at the end of the month, it'll be in name only. And Jeremy Hunt's taken over as Chancellor of the Exchequer, which is the main finance minister, basically. The guy in charge of the guy who delivers the budget to the House of Commons. And has a lot of the input, but to be fair, a lot of what happens with the budget comes from the Bank of England and comes from the mandarins behind the scenes. It's not usually politics. So they'll do a little bit of politics to keep the politicians happy, but most of it is all, you can't change most of it. It's all committed spending. So I've got some clips to play of things that I recorded yesterday. As the process went on, I don't know whether you know what happened yesterday, but Kwasi Kwarteng, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer yesterday morning, is no longer Chancellor of the Exchequer because Jeremy Hunt's taken over. So I've got the processor. I've got a clip of Andrew Marr, who's a political journalist who's been around for years, who's now on LBC, which is a radio station. So I'll start with him. And then I've got a guy called Tim Wilson, I think his name is, who's an academic. I'm not quite sure whether he's a conservative or whether he's somewhere in the middle or what he is. But he's quite a colourful character, and he's been doing like 3-minute videos over the course of the whole process. So I've got some of those lined up as well. That'll do us for now. I'll start with Andrew Marr.
Good evening to you. Now, my job as a reporter, as I see it, is pretty simple. It's to tell you what I think is going on away from the cameras and the microphones as well as in front of them. And there's lots to tell you today. But first, if you'll forgive me, I want to say something a little more personal, because overnight I've been reflecting on an interview I did with Max Hastings, the historian and former Telegraph editor, who talked of his grief as someone who loves this country, about how it was being made to seem absurd in the eyes of the world. Well, I love this country too. I love its weather and its humour and its buildings and its tolerance and variety and its beer. And even, yes, its food. I've written books and made films about its history. Among my family who fought in the last war, we lost a Spitfire pilot over Norway and a very young naval lieutenant at Dunkirk. I'm a patriotic member of a patriotic family, and there is nothing about our current economic and political crisis that doesn't make me squirm with embarrassment and grief. We are a better country than we seem at the moment. And if you ever thought that politics was somehow out there or up there and not your concern, then I'm afraid you will now notice that mistake. Every time you go abroad and feel poorer, and every time you borrow money here at home or face bills here at home, what happens at Westminster happens in your house too. So what did happen at Westminster today? They say that before a volcano erupts, not only does the ground tremble, but you notice a funny smell in the air, a whiff of sulphur. Well, there's been a funny smell this Thursday in the Commons. Rumours were rippling out of Downing Street about a huge U-turn on taxes about to break, with corporation tax going up, not down, to calm the markets. In the early afternoon, the Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, said in Washington, where he's at an international conference, that he remained completely focused on his mini-budget and he wouldn't be resigning, without quite denying that there might be a U-turn. He would tell us more, he said, at the end of the month. I don't think this will hold. Almost immediately after Kwarteng's nothing to see here remarks, the former Tory Chancellor George Osborne tweeted that because of the pain being caused to the real economy, it's not clear why it's in anyone's interests to wait 18 more days before the inevitable U-turn on the mini-budget. And straight away his old opponent, the former Labour Shadow Chancellor Ed Balls, replied, I agree with George. Meanwhile, in almost every corner of Parliament, one-time Tory ministers and experienced Tory MPs were discussing how to get rid of Liz Truss. At the moment, the favourite plan seems to be to assemble a fresh cabinet from different wings of the party and simply confront her with the fact that it's all over before moving in to form a new emergency government, even if Truss is still left as the theoretical leader of the Conservative Party. Outrageous? Brilliant? Impossible? Necessary? I merely report. But perhaps this week the King speaks for all of us when he greets his new Prime Minister with the words, dear, oh dear.
I am reeling from watching the Prime Minister on PMQs this morning. So, as we know, the British economy has unexpectedly shrunk by 0.3%, I think. And we sat there watching or listening to the drivel of repeated slogans by the Prime Minister. And the one question which I really wanted to hear an answer to, it doesn't matter which side of the House you support, whether you support the Conservatives or the Labour Party, or indeed the Greens or the SNP, you want the Prime Minister to answer the question she's asked and she didn't. So the leader of the opposition asked a very specific question about two people who he had met, who had gone to sort out their mortgage application, who were buying their first house, and they were turned down because of the Chancellor's mini budget. And they're aggrieved. What does the Prime Minister have to say to that? And she would not answer. She would not answer again and again. She trotted out rubbish. Much of it was incomprehensible. Much of it was blabbering and stammering away. I mean, I should be sympathetic to somebody who stammers, but I can't be sympathetic to somebody who has no information and who thinks that by frowning and looking as if she was in need of some sort of loo break, we're going to have sympathy for her. No. Why should we have sympathy? She can't play the sympathy card when she deals with people with such contempt, when she doesn't answer the question. And what does she think of these two people who were cited in the Commons as trying to get a mortgage and having it turned down simply because of her Chancellor's mini budget? What does she think of that? I would like to know. And I think many people of all different political colours would like to know what she thinks and indeed what she's planning to do. As for this nonsense about 2 years rather than 6 months, no. Businesses have no idea what's happening in 6 months' time. No idea. They've been given assurances for 6 months and that is it. So the idea that she's tweeting on about 2 years' security, there is no security after this mini budget. She has decimated, I use the word so foolishly, I mean, the word decimate has a very precise meaning. She hasn't decimated, she's destroyed. She's destroyed our future. She's made everything more uncertain at a time when there is such a scythe of uncertainty from the East, from Mr. Putin. Her response to Putin is to rattle everything. What a stupid approach, and the level of stupidity is writ large when she doesn't seem capable of answering a question because she doesn't have the crib in front of her. We need to replace this lame duck Prime Minister, and we need to replace the Chancellor. Where was he this morning? Couldn't he get back from being carpeted by the IMF in time? He should have been sitting next to her. The questions were all about what he had done. Great shame. Kwasi Kwarteng makes the history books, not as the person who has the shortest tenure as Chancellor, but as the second person with the shortest member as a Chancellor. And that's it. I'm delighted. Now we have to find out whether his package remains in any form, and then we have to find out how badly tainted Liz Truss is by association. I think that she is going to be very lucky to cling on. No doubt Sajid Javid will move in to number 11 as the new Chancellor. He's the most likely candidate, unless somebody like Penny Mordaunt steps in. That would also be a possibility. That would be quite a plus. But I think it's highly likely that Liz Truss will be so badly damaged by this, she cannot limp on any longer, and nor should she. Let's see what happens in the next hour or so. But I am delighted this arrogant individual has gone. And he certainly didn't know about it yesterday, did he?
My conviction that this country needs to go for growth is rooted in my personal experience. I know what it's like to grow up somewhere that isn't feeling the benefits of growth. I saw what that meant, and I'm not prepared to accept that for our country. I want a country where people can get good jobs, new businesses can set up, and families can afford an even better life. That's why, from day one, I've been ambitious for growth. Since the 2008 financial crisis, the potential of this great country has been held back by persistently weak growth. I want to deliver a low tax, high wage, high growth economy. It's what I was elected by my party to do. That mission remains. People across this country rightly want stability. That's why we acted to support businesses and households with their energy costs this winter. It's also the case that global economic conditions are worsening due to the continuation of Putin's appalling war in Ukraine. And on top of this, debt was amassed helping people through the COVID pandemic. But it is clear that parts of our mini budget went further and faster than markets were expecting. So the way we are delivering our mission right now has to change. We need to act now to reassure the markets of our fiscal discipline. I have therefore decided to keep the increase in corporation tax that was planned by the previous government. This will raise £18 billion per year. It will act as a down payment on our full medium-term fiscal plan, which will be accompanied by a forecast from the independent OBR. We will do whatever is necessary to ensure debt is falling as a share of the economy in the medium term. We will control the size of the state to ensure that taxpayers' money is always well spent. Our public sector will become more efficient to deliver world-class services for the British people. And spending will grow less rapidly than previously planned. I met the former Chancellor earlier today. I was incredibly sorry to lose him. He is a great friend, and he shares my vision to set this country on the path to growth. Today, I have asked Jeremy Hunt to become the new Chancellor. He's one of the most experienced and widely respected government ministers and parliamentarians, and he shares my convictions and ambitions for our country. He will deliver the medium-term fiscal plan at the end of this month. He will see through the support we are providing to help families and businesses, including our energy price guarantee that's protecting people from higher energy bills this winter. And he will drive our mission to go for growth, including taking forward the supply-side reforms that our country needs. We owe it to the next generation to improve our economic performance, to deliver higher wages, new jobs, and better public services, and to ease the burden of debt. I have acted decisively today because my priority is ensuring our country's economic stability. As Prime Minister, I will always act in the national interest. This is always my first consideration. I want to be honest, this is difficult, but we will get through this storm, and we will deliver the strong and sustained growth that can transform the prosperity of our country for generations to come.
Range of newspapers, but not least the Eye and the Independent, but so with very much the hat on. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is not an accident that the Prime Minister, back to the wall, goes first to the Telegraph, then to the Sun, and then obligatory BBC ITN.
Yeah, goes to the papers that are most likely to support her, and I think it says rather a lot that those papers were not really in a very conciliatory mood. I think Harry Cole's question there, you know, you came as a pair, he's gone, surely you have to go. I think that sums it up.
I think that's like they're calling the trade a zinger.
Yeah, I thought, yeah, I agree.
Harry
I thought,
does zingers. Yeah. Harry Cole does zingers.
He doesn't very well. I do agree. I thought she looked remarkably steely, but steely in the way that a football manager who's just been shellacked 6-0 and knows Sam Allardyce is about to replace him says, I have the full backing of the board. That was the vibe that I got. You know, obviously she has to put out a united front, but quite clearly this was a chastening experience. And whatever's gone before has been even more so.
Catherine, she also, on the economics of it, but there's a very important political nuance to this, given what the three of us have been talking about, and also Claire when she was here. Spending will now grow less rapidly than had been planned, and I am incredibly sorry, her adjective, incredibly sorry to see Quasi go.
Yes, but will it be enough? What struck me most, really, was the questions. There was no friendly journalist anywhere to be seen. They were very brutal. They were pretty much all on a theme, which is, how can you stay? Where's your credibility? And will you apologise? And I thought she looked quite lost. She was looking around to find someone. And I thought, why did they not give her a list of questions? So you go, Harry Cole, yeah. You know, she just looked. I found it was actually quite hard to watch.
It's an interesting point because we all know, because we've all done it on occasion, that there is a list. There must have. She would not have gone to that podium without a list. And you often saw Boris making a joke almost. Oh, where we go? Oh, piston. Yeah. And off you jolly well go. I mean,
all right. So that's a range of the coverage that was happening. So Tim Wilson's on YouTube. He's basically posting video, 2 or 3 minute videos, 4 minutes sometimes, but 2 or 3 times a day. It's been recently because there's just been so much to comment on. So it was just a running commentary. I found it amusing. I found his commentary amusing. So I thought I'll play some of that. Incidentally, I'm live from my kitchen again, and the kitchen's working pretty well as a studio space. It's set up reasonably well. I've got the laptop next to the toaster, and this Rodecaster Pro 2 gadget next to the slow cooker. So it kind of works in its own way, and the microphone's between the two of them. I may at some point post a video of me in the kitchen doing a radio show on my Odyssey channel or on BitChute or somewhere. But if you want to see any of that, or Rumble, there's a locals community called Free Association Radio, Dennis Barker Free Association Radio Show, I think it's called. So if you find my Rumble channel, which is called Radio Projects, this is complicated because I keep changing names halfway through projects. So the Rumble channel is called Radio Projects with an S, and the connecting community is called Dennis Barker Free Association or Free Association Radio Show, something of that sort. That if you want to see my kitchen, that's where I'll post the video of the kitchen. I've just made an executive decision, and that's where it'll be. So you're welcome to join me there. You can ask questions, post information, whatever. It's a community, so it's designed to be shared. Shared information, shared questions, shared understanding, however it works. I don't think there's anybody in there at the moment, so everybody's welcome. All right, so what else do I want to talk about today? I've got a piece lined up, which is James Giordano, who is a neuroethics guy at Georgetown University, but I'm not going to do that yet. I've just it occurred to me that I ought to describe the city. This weekend in the city is the Rugby League World Cup at St. James's Park, which is the main soccer stadium. So there's a rugby competition going on, which means that quite a lot of the city centre is kind of off limits to the locals. They've kind of cordoned off a part of the quayside and put down artificial grass and a stage, and there's some burger vans and some food stores, various food stores and what have you down there, and that's the official place for the fans to spend their time. So they've kind of got everybody kettled in particular areas, and so the rugby fans are on the quayside. I was up at the monument at 1 o'clock. I went up there because there's a demonstration going on. I nearly took a recording gadget up there, but I didn't do it this time. I might do it next time. But I only stayed about 20 minutes, 25 minutes. I know a few people who were up there from the Friday afternoon demonstration that I do. So I just called in to say hello, show my face, and I really had to come down here and decide what I wanted to do with the radio show. So they'll probably still be there, but I'm not spending all afternoon up there when I spent an hour and a half at a demonstration on the Tyne Bridge yesterday. So The Friday afternoon demos are getting smaller. We had an issue with a guy who was high on some kind of drugs and alcohol. They wanted to steal the... it was an altercation, and a small injury to somebody's head occurred. And since then, it's kind of fizzled out a little bit. There's a smaller number of people who are showing up. I haven't been there for a couple of weeks. I took a couple of weeks off. But I went back yesterday, and it's a group of about, it used to be a group of maybe 20, 25 people, and it now looks like it's about 10 people. So it's dropped by half. And understandably, I think, because the weather's getting a bit colder and it's getting wet, so it's less comfortable to stand on the bridge or stand on St. James's Boulevard in the cold and wet than it is in the summer. So I totally understand that. And I won't be doing them all. I'll be doing maybe 2 out of 3, but I won't be doing every week. Simply because it takes over your life if you do it every week. And I don't want it to take over my life. I want to have my life first and just integrate protests and demonstrations into my life. So it's a small part of what I do. That's why I did an hour and a quarter. I think I did standing with a board yesterday. And then I did about 20 minutes, 25 minutes at the demonstration this afternoon. So I've done my 2 hours, more or less. So I've done the equivalent of standing on the Tyne Bridge for 2 hours, but I did it in 2 places over 2 days. And I think I'll be at Stand in the Park tomorrow, so it's not like I'm doing nothing. And plus I've got this piece from James Giordano to play, so I'm going to do that now. The only way I can introduce it is I've been watching video interviews of Karen Kingston. So on the Stu Peters show and with Mike Adams, and she keeps mentioning this name, James Giordano. So I thought I'll take a look at him. I'll take a look and find out what he's about. And there's a 2 or 3 videos on YouTube. I was surprised. He's a neuroethics specialist. So he's a specialist in how to in the necessary ethics of manipulating people's thoughts. So it's a controversial topic, that's to be said, and there's several different viewpoints, and Karen Kingston's got one viewpoint, James Giordano himself's got another viewpoint, but I'm going to let him speak for himself. I'm just rambling now, so let me set this up.
James Giordano here today from Georgetown University. He is a professor. I have to read this because it's a lot. He's a professor in the development of neurobiology and biochemistry. He's a chief of neuroethics studies program and the co-director of the O'Neill Pellegrino program in brain science and the global health law and policy at Georgetown University. He served on the joint staff of the Pentagon, and in this area, he heads up the EU Human Brain Project. He's going to talk a little bit about that today. He's tasked with his work is dedicated to the studying and defining of current and political dual-use capabilities in neuroscience and neurotechnology. It's an extremely in-depth discussion. I encourage you guys to ask questions at the end. His area is his expertise is in brain science and can be developed and engaged in military applications, warfare applications, bioweapons, both by state and non-state actors. So I'm going to head it over to Jim.
Okay, thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's my second or third time being out at Livermore. I've been working for a while with Zach, and that's been a real pleasure, and of course my ongoing work with Paris and company. As Paris mentioned, one of the things that I do is I do brain science. I've worked in the area of translational brain science, which is bringing brain science from the research bench to the bedside for about the past 32 years. So I've been doing this for a while. Brain science, as you may know, has also had a fairly rapid development and trajectory of its capabilities, moving from fairly simple approaches to studying the brain to far more complicated approaches that I'll talk to you about today. But like with so many other areas of science and technology, the capability that is conferred by the science, that is the knowledge, and its techniques and its technology, therefore its tools, giving us implements, to affect in some way a biological system, renders it relatively powerful to do a whole host of things. Now, as Paris mentioned, of course, I also work as the chief of an ethics center at Georgetown. I'm working within the Pellegrino Center for Clinical Bioethics. And what I do is an area called neuroethics, a relatively new field, but not per se. The idea is that the title of neuroethics has only been around since about 2002 in formal use. But the idea of understanding the ethics, legal, social issues, regulatory issues that arise from any science and technology are quite old. What makes neuroethics a bit more interesting and perhaps unique is that the thing that we use as the focus of our study, the brain and those techniques and technologies that go into studying the brain and in some ways affecting the brain, remain relatively unknown to us. I don't care how you twist this. There's really none of us in this room, and I've been a brain scientist for over 3 decades, who could tell you how the great stuff, cognition, emotion, and even behavior, arise in and from that gray stuff of those squirting, squigging cells that exist in your head. We don't know that. But we're going to be Aristotelian for a moment and sort of wax philosophically. What I could tell, oh, you enjoyed it. That's good. So as I always look for the philosopher in the crowd who gets the Aristotelian gig. The issue is very simple. We don't understand what's called the efficient cause of what the brain does. We know how it works as a basic biological system. We might even speculate, and very realistically, why it's important to a biological system. But do we know how the brain makes, quote, mind? No, we don't. Yet, that doesn't stop us, because there's something called the mechanistic paradox, which is although we need to understand the mechanism of how and why something works, we also fall victim to the fact that very often we use what's called satisficing information. In other words, good enough for government work and we'll just proceed on smartly. Moreover, what that also does is raises the intersection of a host of unknowns. If we don't know how the thing that we're affecting works, well, the beauty of it is the tools that we develop help us to understand that. But then we have to revise what we think are the key issues that come from our tool use on that thing. This is not what's called reductio ad absurdum. This is not reductive thinking. It's real. That said, let me take you on a little trip in time to brain sciences, what they really do. Let me move this down here because I'm so short you can't see me over the bottle of water. So this slide, I think, very nicely demonstrates for you a relative 100-year history of the brain sciences, going back to an anatomical diagram that was pioneered right after the advent of anesthesia in the middle of the 1800s to be able to allow direct access to the living brain neurosurgically. Now, what that allowed us to do is to manipulate the structure of the brain and, as a consequence of that, see what artifacts occurred with regard to individuals' thought, emotionality, and behaviors. Of course, we all know the prototypic example being Phineas Gage, the railroad worker who got a tamping iron through his frontal lobes, and as a consequence of that, survived, but as the adage says, Phineas was Phineas no more. So the issue here is that there's something ticking away within your cranium that makes you, you. That renders the brain sciences exceedingly important, not any more perhaps in certain ways than other areas of the biomedical sciences, but in ways that are both practical and philosophical. In other words, if I'm able to in some way assess and affect this thing that is in at least some way demonstrably and perhaps to a large extent responsible for making you you, your persona, your thoughts, your hopes, your dreams, well, look at the power that that can yield. We like to talk about influencing hearts and minds, but this is a question of influencing brains to influence hearts to then influence minds. Continue to look at the slide, because what you see is the interesting dance that essentially technology has allowed the brain sciences to advance. We've gone from these rather rudimentary examples of utilizing these techniques of surgery during the beginning of the last century, the 1900s, to being able to utilize ever more sophisticated anatomical and molecular probes to understand the brain at a variety of ever more nuanced and granular levels, and ultimately to not even have to intervene with the actual structure of the brain, but to be able to assess the brain in real time, utilizing convergent forms of neuroimaging coupled to a host of neuroelectrophysiological techniques. It's been very, very important. Because what this allows us to do is essentially something akin to this, both literally and metaphorically, which is to essentially put the brain at our fingertips. This is my brain. I take it out nightly and floss it with my haircut. It makes it rather easy. But there is something I want you to also understand about this. If you were to do exactly as I'm doing here in this slide, which you were to put your brain in front of you, first of all, the mere size of it, I think, is somewhat interesting to people. We tend to think it's a lot larger. It's not. It fits in the palm of your hands. But now let's wax a little more philosophical but very practical with that same analogy. If this is something that fits in the palm of your hand, every hope, every dream, every thought, every aspiration, everything you love, everything you hate fits in that organ. And if I really wanted to wax philosophical, everything that humanity has ever done and will be is a consequence of that organ's function. Once again, we're talking about power. But let me tell you a little neuroanatomical and neuroscientific adage. We have a saying in the brain sciences, see one brain, see one brain. Which means that despite the fact that if I pulled my brain out of my head and his brain out of her, his and her brain out of hers, it would basically look like that with regard to its gross architecture. The devils and deities lie in the details. Our brains develop as a consequence of their embodiment in me and you, and as a consequence of the environments we work in. Which means that what the brain sciences are helping to do is to figure out both what brains have in common and what brains have in difference. Now, the beauty of that is, through the iterative use of big data, what we're able to do is to create large-scale patterns, maps, atlases of not only individual brains, but groups of brains, and use these things comparatively and normatively. The more we know, the bolder we go. Puts the brain at our fingertips. But what you want to see is that the brain sciences have, in fact, created a tremendous amount of momentum and potential. And that is the momentum to be able to assess, access, and effect. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. What it really does is it creates an opportunity to affect the way humans think, feel, and behave on a variety of levels. And those levels don't only extend within the individual organism. In other words, being able to affect thought, emotion, behavior with regard to ranging all the way from the synaptic to our social interactions individually. But it also allows us to then exert certain levels of intellectual assessment, knowledge acquisition, and control about human relations on the individual to cohort to group to community to local, regional, even global scale. And obviously, we can, in fact, use that information and arguably the capacity to be able to not just use the information, but to actually physically affect the brain through these techniques and tools in ways that are important to, meaningful for, and highly leverageable within national security, intelligence, and defense agenda. This is no different than other forms of science and technology. Arguably, one could say that the individual with the most sophisticated science and technology has always looked to bring those into those agendas to defend kin and kith, to be able to advance an ideology, to be able to defend those things we hold dear. History teaches us that. Latest and greatest tools are very often incorporated into these large-scale agenda, particularly by mechanized and technological countries. We've seen this historically throughout the ages, this being no different. So the idea that we're able to say is that the leverageability of the brain sciences extends from the synaptic to the social, from the individual to the global, is not just a lot of fancy rhetoric. It is, in fact, real and realizable. Moreover, in utilizing the brain sciences in these ways, I think it becomes important to understand a formal definition of a term that I will use repeatedly throughout this lecture. This term, a weapon. As directly cited from the Oxford English Dictionary, there are two interactive and I think important definitions of a weapon you need to understand. The first is as a means of contending against another. We hear this colloquially. You know, someone who has a great sense of humor says, oh, their sense of humor is a real weapon. In other words, they can use it well to interact with others positively and in some cases derisively. The old sort of film noir movies where it showed the sultry woman sitting in the bar and she'd show some leg and be like, those gams are a weapon. Those kind of things. Yeah, it's a means of contending against another. For those of you who are far younger than I, gams is a slang for legs. It doesn't necessarily have to be in a derogative or denigrative way. It is a way of contending against another. I can use humor as a weapon to disarm someone. I can use affability as a weapon to make what may have been a potential foe or hostile my friend. But I think the way that we use the word weapon more colloquially is the one that comes to mind and should not be ignored in this context, which is this: something that can be used to injure, defeat, and or destroy another, a potential enemy. Put them both together, you have this wonderful 25-buck definition, and I usually impugn anyone who reads off a PowerPoint slide, but I just want to reinforce the definition. Something that mitigates aggression and fosters thoughts and feelings of affiliation or passivity. Oh, in other words, if I make my enemy my friend, not my enemy any longer, that's still weaponizable, and or something that incurs burdens of morbidity and or mortality. The idea of this is something not only used to influence and deter, but actually to, in some way, mitigate or prevent an individual from exercising those actions towards me and mine. If we look at weapons, and we were to trace these historically, I think Ruddington provides a very, very good overview of the history of weapons. There are a number of different books that could provide this for you. Everything from somebody picking up a rock and using it a la 2001, A Space Odyssey, all the way up to the contemporary use of very, very sophisticated forms in S&T. What we see is as the momentum of S&T increases, the weaponizability of that science and technology in a variety of realms also increases. It used to be that I need to be exceedingly close to someone to now influence them with a weapon, and now what we see is we create both distal potential as well as much more capable potential to affect them in a variety of different ways, ranging from the sublime all the way up to the severe. So we know this to exist. There are two types of weapons, those that are called soft weapons and those that are called hard weapons. If we now take a look at the brain sciences as weaponizable, a real word, by the way, we can see that, in fact, the brain sciences are weaponizable across both dimensions, soft weaponizability and hard weaponizability. In the former sense, we're seeing that the neurosciences can be used to gain economic leverage, not least of which is because neuroscience and technology commands and captures $175 billion annual market space. There's a tremendous amount of global economic leverage that can be occurred and affected, but can also be used for somewhat softer applications in the national security space, inclusive of intelligence purposes, and the use of neuro and cognitive sciences to develop insights to and techniques for psychological operations and information systems, what is referred to in military parlance as PSYOPs and MISO. If we now transition that into more hard forms of weaponizability, these are the areas where we're actually looking to exert physical, not just cognitive influence and or deterrence. These are your more classical forms of weaponization where you actually see things like guns, bullets, bombs, etc. But now, when confined to the biological space, we see chemicals such as drugs and other chemical agents, biological such as the use of various microbes with bacteria and viruses and toxins, and increasingly devices, which up until quite recently were not even considered to be in the weaponizable space, and only very recently, with regard to the last review conference of the International Biological Toxins and Weapons Convention last December, did the Australia group raise the possibility that certain devices, namely neurotechnology and hybrid cyborg-type devices, which we'll talk about, should be considered within the larger scale of what might be a potential biological. So what we're seeing is we need to cast a broader net as we increase broader and ever more sophisticated capabilities. Still with me? Okay. In fact, what we're doing here is just...
All right, I think that's probably enough for you to get an idea. The video goes on for about another hour, just about an hour. I'm about halfway through it, so I've got no fixed opinions on this guy at the moment. I know that that he's worth investigating, so that's basically what I'm doing. 6 months ago I probably wouldn't have taken Karen Kingston seriously, but now I do. So that's a shift that's happened in me, and it's interesting that it's happened that way. I always resist until I change my mind, don't I? So I'm used to that. All right, where else do I want to go with this? I'm just going to talk, I think. I mean, because I'm in a weird mood. So if I just talk, then something ridiculous is probably going to come out of my mouth at some point, and it'll keep me amused, if nothing else. So, yeah, I'm in the process. Here's a thing. The last 3 weeks, starting the beginning of September, I applied for a job doing door-to-door canvassing with a company that I won't name, but they're based, they've got a base in Newcastle, so they kind of go out from Newcastle around the city and knock on doors and do various marketing campaigns. So I applied for this job at the beginning of September. Didn't hear anything back. Got a text message at the beginning of October saying, come in on this date. Was it a Monday or a Tuesday? I think it was. And we'll do a group presentation. So I went along. And it's a marketing company, so they're marketing themselves before they even get to the point where you work out the job. So it's effectively it's kind of it's a network marketing slash sales operation. So it's a teams of door-to-door canvassers on commission only, going out, and the campaign is for a teenage cancer charity, so it's something that I've got an interest in anyways, is health. So this is a support charity for teenagers with cancer. So I'll see what it is. I'm open-minded enough to take a look at it. I can do it Monday to Thursday, which means that I can have Friday to do other things and prep the radio show and do various other things that I need to do. And they're okay with me doing 4 days a week. It's self-employed, so it means that if I'm signing people up, I make money. If I'm not signing people up, I don't make money. I've got to do 4 days a week. But the 4 days a week suits me because it fits in with my schedule. So I'll finish about 8 o'clock or 8:30, depending on how far away from the city I am. Then I've got half an hour, 45 minutes, maybe an hour of traveling on a bad day, I think. Can't imagine there being more than about 45 minutes on the metro, on the public transport system. That's about the limit of how far you can go. And I did tell them I need to be back for 9 o'clock, and nobody said you won't be back for 9 o'clock so far. So I've had a few conversations. Nobody's even mentioned the possibility of not being home at 9 o'clock in the evening. So I'm going to assume that that's going to happen until I find out otherwise. But I do want to do the radio show on Podbean, and that starts at 9 o'clock. So I can be flexible about it a little bit, but I'm not going to be too flexible about it. If they've said that I can be home by 9 o'clock, then I expect them to honour that. 5 past is all right, maybe at a push even 10 past, but I don't want to be getting back at 9:45 and missing the whole show on Podbean. So it looks like it'll work. The obstacle I've come across at the moment is that they want photo ID, and I don't have photo ID. I don't drive, and I don't have a passport. So there's a kind of process going on where I've applied for a thing called a citizen card, which I didn't even know that a citizen card existed 2 weeks ago. But it's a form of photo ID, and it's relatively easy to get. So I've arranged to do that. I paid for it. I'm waiting for it to arrive. It should have arrived yesterday, in theory, or this morning, and it hasn't so far. So something's going on with it. So that's a delay in a process that's just basically a delay. But it's my own fault for applying for jobs during a Mercury retrograde. What can I expect? My birthday is in September, ruled by Mercury, so Mercury retrogrades are very significant in my life, believe it or not. They are very significant. But I'm used to them. I'm used to them. So I don't take them overly seriously. I just treat them like a way to redo things and bang your head against the wall for 3 weeks. That's kind of how I approach Mercury retrograde. So they're useful because I go internal a bit more. I know that the technology is going to work a little bit less efficiently and the process is going to be slower, and things are not going to quite turn out the way I expect them to. So I have a tendency to go internal a little bit and review things. I remembered a thing called Be Set Free Fast, which I'd totally forgotten about. So I've been doing that a little bit. It's a thing that it's on. There's a the manual. The videos are on YouTube. There's a DVD set of 20 minutes or half an hour videos on YouTube. And it was a thing that a guy called Larry Nims came up with. I think it's Nims, in presumably the 70s. Or maybe the 80s, but he's a clinical psychologist, if I remember rightly, and the process is very good. I get a lot of positive results from Be Set Free Fast. I'm not trained in it. I'm not somebody who's been. I did a coaching call with a woman in the States about 5 years ago, something like that. She was doing free half an hour coaching sessions and upselling. Like $3,000 worth of coaching on the back of it. So, but to her credit, she did go through the whole process and take me through it. I'd already been doing it, so I'd already come up, I'd already kind of been through the process a few times, and I'm quite intuitive anyway. So the questions she was asking me, I already kind of had answers for, which speeded up the process nicely. She's been trained, and obviously she's a trained psychoanalyst or whatever. She's got qualifications in complicated things that I don't have. So she did it in a bit more of a rigorous way than the way that I've been doing it myself. All right, that's it. I'm rambling, and I've come to the end of the show, and I'll be back next week. See you then. Thanks for listening.
Everyone, it's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Hi, I'm Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Are you interested in the paranormal? Murder mystery? Real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's iPhone, thank you. Welcome to the Crypt.
What the heck is the truth, jihad? Hey, I'm Kevin Barrett, host of Truth Jihad Radio.